Shalom Yehudim, Shalom Bnei Noach, Shalom Goyim. It's the evening of the fourth day, Kaf Dalas B'Iyar, Parashas B'Midbar, Tavshinayim Vav, the evening of the third day, Tuesday, 31 May 2016, webcasting from Israel, home of the Jews, ever striving for peace and never getting it. The peace process, so-called, is like an old-fashioned TV soap opera that never ends. Will Israel and the Palestinians get back together at the negotiating table? That's almost a weekly or even daily news story around here. The top heading in the J Post today was, quote, "In surprise move, PM says he's ready to negotiate based on Saudi peace plan. Post learned that Hanegbi will help Netanyahu lead new push. Bennett said to be opposed to change in stance," close quote. Quoted directly later on was the PM, who said, quote, "We are ready to negotiate with the Arab states on an updated draft that reflects the dramatic regional changes that have occurred since 2002, but which maintains the agreed-upon goal of two states for two peoples," close quote. I read that and thought, this guy is a serious taurine excreta artist. He's saying, yes, let's talk peace, using your demands on the table, and when Israel talks, Israel point out the danger of retreating, because in our place will come ISIS or Al-Qaeda, Hamas or Hezbollah, meaning Iran, and Israel will not agree to commit suicide. It will do whatever is necessary to survive. It will do nothing to weaken its defense, and under those conditions, Israel will gladly sit at the same table with the Saudis to discuss their plan. You might also add that peace means a public declaration by Riyadh saying that the Jews in their ancient homeland are no longer to be judged dhimmi. They no longer belong to a Sharia-mandated second-class community. They are entitled to their independence. Saudis have to say that. Oh, it's all blah, blah. I think Bibi is just, to borrow a sports metaphor, running out the clock until January 20, 2017, when the secret Muslim agent leaves the White House. A curse be upon him. In that epic Jeffrey Goldberg riff on Obama's foreign policy, we learned that Obama's former speechwriter, one Jon Favreau, recently said that he and Ben Rhodes and Obama viewed, quote, their entire job as restructuring the American narrative. Whew, absolutely. It's what Obama advertised before his first election in 2008. He was going to fundamentally change America, and that means changing the American narrative. In his first inaugural address, he dropped hints that this would mean turning America's back on Israel and favoring Israel's mortal enemies. He also subtly slapped the Jewish people in the face in that speech, and then immediately in the next sentence turned to Islam and promised a new beginning. And boy, has that ever been true. Instead of standing up to outrages against Americans overseas in terrorist attacks, Obama began to be the Muslims' defense lawyer to the American people. When a video of mass beheadings by Muslims surfaced, and in particular American citizens among the victims, Obama sermonized to the American people not to rush to judgment, not to forget the Crusades and how cruel the Crusaders were. Instead of defending the American people from Muslim terrorists, he defended Muslim terrorists to the American people. He also trashed the classic American hatred of communism, manifest in a half century of bipartisan support for an anti-Castro embargo of Cuba. One of Obama's mentors was the editor of the Communist Party newspaper in Chicago. His father, too, I believe, was a bit of a Stalinist. Obama's fundamental change was remaking America in his own pro-Muslim, pro-communist image by forbidding, like a communist, commissar in the United States administration, use of the term Islamic or Muslim terrorism. He identified himself as a defender of Muslim terrorists. Oh, how I envy future historians who will be scratching their heads over this generation of Americans who did nothing to stop this man. They even elected him a second time. How to explain this paralysis in the face of hostility and traitorous behavior? How to explain the cowardice of the American people? Otherwise, intelligent people have been in denial about Obama's traitorous behavior, his freeing of terrorist big shots in order to get back one Muslim traitor in the U.S. Army, his release of Muslim terrorists from Gitmo who have returned to terror against Americans. And the American people have been wimps in the face of this man. So there's much material for future historians, including this admission that this speechwriter Jon Favreau, Ben Rhodes, and Obama saw their entire job restructuring the American narrative. And I say beware of the word narrative, which is used here in the way Edward Said began using it in the 1960s and 70s. He preached that Zionism may have been a worthy goal for the Jews, but for his putatively prehistoric people, it was a catastrophe, a Nakba. And ever since, the term narrative is used in a sly kind of way, in postmodernist fashion, to indicate that truth has many versions, and they're all of equal worth. The Zionist narrative, romanticized in Leon Uris's historical romance Exodus, was the Jewish narrative, and the Palestinians have their narrative, too, according to which the Jews were criminal villains at that time. That's the Palestinian narrative, and what racist or Islamophobe dares criticize this narrative as a fairy tale, as a string of lies. These three horsemen of the apocalypse, Obama, Rhodes, and Favreau, rewrote the American narrative. As that lunatic American Jewish historian Howard Zinn used to, in order to portray the country in an evil light. Hence Obama's apology tour when he took office. The public desire he expressed for a new relationship between Islam and America, when American foreign policy, all countries' foreign policies, is conducted between states, not with religions. Obama's fundamental change in the Middle East was to be favoring Iran over Israel, when Iran had long publicly, shamelessly toyed in public with the idea of nuking Israel, God forbid. 2009, there was an attempted uprising against the regime that got not even lip service from this man. He ordered all references to Islam and terrorism in military courses and manuals expunged. And we're still worried about what more he can do against Israel before he leaves office, which worry may have triggered Prime Minister's latest page one sentence, that he will consider the Saudi initiative as a base for discussions. I think he's just treading water, running out the clock. It does not mean anything. For if Israel were forced into sitting down with the Saudis, so what? This has been the secular Zionist dream from day one in any case. They do not want the Arabs to treat Israelis as if they were Jews. Zionism was paradoxically, for many of the early Zionists, not a movement to rescue the Jewish people, but abandon them and create a new Jew, unlike the old Jew that everybody hated. I have vivid memories of another old Israeli flame telling me in all sincerity that she was an Israeli and not a Jew. The Israelis versus the Jews. A dream that in the state of Israel, life will become indistinguishable from life in Europe or the U.S. or Canada or Australia. None of that chosen people stuff. And such types are now running the Jerusalem Post, which keeps piling on the column inches in page after page with stories about transgenders. There was a beauty contest in Tel Aviv the other day, won by an Arab from the Galilee, I think, and there was one article about that and two other and maybe even three others in the same edition about these unfortunate people. In the once serious Friday Magazine Post, it seems once a month now, there's another article about the LGBT community. And, of course, the graphics accompanying these articles are photos of men dressed as women that were judged before the 1960s as pornography. The Jerusalem Post is publishing what used to be called pornography. Sexual deviance. Sex is an act of pleasure having nothing to do with bringing into the world more children to raise and love and educate. Hedonism is a good word for the LGBT community. I've personally come to the view that all sexual deviance is as much of an addiction as alcoholism and as powerful as any heroin addiction, even crack addiction. All of them induce intense physical pleasure, which addicts the user and enslaves him. So-called transgender male is one who is aroused by putting on women's clothes and becomes so addicted to the pleasure it enslaves him and he wants it 24/7. In this light, all perversions are addictions to one's own endorphins, chemical cousins of morphine and heroin, and no good can come from this degenerate acceptance in Western society of the last half century of unnatural sexual behavior. It's unnatural because the pleasure of procreation is stripped from the process of creating new life. It exploits conjugal relations for the pleasure, but discards the purpose of the activity, which is the most godlike thing a human being can do. Create another person.
Thank you.
So let's see on the political domestic front, my least favorite sphere in Israel. Lieberman is now defense minister. And I think there were other switches and more musical chairs. I wish I had $1 million to hire an efficiency expert to do a time and motion study on Israeli politicians in the government and the Knesset to discover how much time during the day they put in serving the public versus socializing and celebrating and making toasts to one another over the composition of a new cabinet. There is much to take pride in Israel, but not its political system. On the foreign affairs front, in opposition to the BDS success among academics in the West against Israel, this week some 150 security professionals from more than 440 countries are going to fly into Ben Gurion Airport and be given a crash course, pun intended, in how to protect one's airplanes from homicidal Muslim maniacs. But of course, that language is mine and not those organizing this learning session. There are those calling for boycotts of Israel and others who recognize Israeli excellence in various fields, and they would be fools to boycott what Israel has learned and has to teach when confronted by, again my words, Islamic devils who are so intellectually and spiritually defective in their minds and hearts they have no scruples about placing bombs on airliners to blow them out of the sky. These are homicidal Muslim maniacs. And no good can come from enemies of Western civilization, like Barack Obama, who deliberately covers up the Islamic sanction for this type of demonic behavior. Men who place bombs on commercial airliners to blow them up in midair are agents of the devil. If there is a devil, they are his agents. The devil, by the way, rarely, if ever, violates nature. Only God can do that. Violates natural laws, engages in magical events. No, the devil works inside normal human beings and leads them to commit horrors for him. And now, in the follow-up to the ongoing BDS campaign, last webcast support for the Dutch foreign minister, who says BDS is legal free speech. And now we have the Irish Foreign Minister Charles Flanagan, due to visit Israel this month, in June, who likewise supports the legitimate right of the BDS campaign to call for boycotting Israel. But I certainly did not go on to say, as he did, quote, "I do not agree with attempts to demonize those who advocate the policy or to equate them with violent terrorists." Now, this is simply intolerable. There's no contradiction between recognizing BDS right to free speech and recognizing the ulterior motive of destroying Israel and the truth that BDS people support the terrorists. In this, the BDS types deserve to be described as he described them. They demonize themselves by their ulterior motives and by the fact that free speech is not a guarantee that the speech spoken will be truthful or not a cesspool of lies about Jews, which it often is. The Irish view of the BDS campaign is legitimate. Flanagan explicitly said BDS is, quote, a legitimate political viewpoint, which he could not say if he allowed himself to see beneath the surface of their dishonest propaganda. They use the so-called occupation of Judea and Samaria as a diversion from their ulterior and ultimate ambition, the destruction of the entire state of Israel, God forbid. That is not a legitimate political viewpoint. And the reason Ireland's foreign minister can speak as he does is the legitimacy that Israel gives to the Palestinian narrative. At Bar-Ilan, Prime Minister Netanyahu saluted the rightness of a state for the Palestinian people, and since then anti-Jews have been waiting for Netanyahu to follow through on this. So as for Irish Foreign Minister Flanagan, he's wrong in calling the BDS movement legitimate, not when its aspiration is destroying the only Jewish state on the planet, though it does have the legal right to protest Israel's continuing presence in Judea and Samaria, so long as Israel does not follow through on its government's oft-repeated desire for the two-state solution. What I'm saying is that Flanagan is encouraged in his reprehensible support for BDS, which does cheer on the terrorists, by an Israel that agrees that Israel must retreat from Judea and Samaria. So Flanagan is wrong that BDS is a legitimate movement, not when its ultimate goal is death to Israel, but it can remain a legal movement, which is not the same thing, remain legal within the boundaries of free speech, which does not permit direct calls for murder, which BDS does not engage in. It's a kind of reverse situation created by Ronald Reagan at the beginning of his first term when he said the settlements were legal but not legitimate in the framework of searching for peace. In other words, they were unhelpful, legal but unhelpful. And here we have John Flanagan of Ireland, who mixes up legal and legitimate in the reverse direction. BDS is legitimate, he says, when it is not, but it is legal. Listening to www.deprogramprogram.com, broadcasting from the hills of Judea. I'm Shai Bentakoa. Now, here's a news item that rings my bell. Last Wednesday, the New York Times, writing up the packing of the Democratic Party Platform Committee by Sanders, the anti-Jew communist from Brooklyn, Times used the expression in quotes, "Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza," for which journalist Glenn Greenwald mocked the Times for using the quotes, as he says, quote, "abject cowardice." Greenwald, for those who don't know, is a tragically twisted soul, an Israel-bashing Jew and aggressive sodomite. Apparently, following his insult, the sodomite-supporting Times removed the quotes. Greenwald wrote up the incident about the Times for The Intercept, which I'm not familiar with, where he wrote, quote, "This is journalistic malfeasance at its worst, refusing to describe the world truthfully out of fear of the negative reaction by influential factions," close quote. The this is rubbish. You know, the Jewish lobby won't let the Times publish as it wants. Greenwald, I consider, even lower down on the scale of contemptible anti-Jew Jews, the journalists variety, like Jeffrey Goldberg. He is adamant that the truth is that Israel is an occupation of the West Bank, which the quotes in the Times seem to cast doubt on. Anti-Jew Jews like Greenwald are incapable of playing defense lawyer for Israel, which is the eternal target of lunatics. Instead, this sexual invert, which used to be a clinical term, is also inverted in his political views about the people he was born into. It is not difficult to make the case for Israeli sovereignty in Judean Samaria, but twisted fellows like Greenwald never do. When it comes to supporting millions of fellow Jews, they are paralyzed. This incident, by the way, reminds me of a point I illustrate in my book. In the 1950s and 60s, when the same New York Times reported on Arab terrorists, they called them, what do you know, terrorists, without quotation marks. But with the birth of the hallucinatory Palestinians, when it literally became life-threatening for journalists in the region to call the PLO's terrorists, the Times began using quotes around the word to indicate to the reader that the judgment that they were terrorists was not that of the New York Times. It came from an Israeli official or some supporter of Israel. Via the quotes, the reader is to understand that it's not the position of the Times that they're terrorists. In their own eyes, they are freedom fighters. Thus was instituted the practice at the Times of never writing terrorist without quotes, and it is this practice, likely inadvertently committed, that lit the fuse of Glenn Greenwald. How dare the Times not agree that Israel is occupying land that rightfully belongs to the victims of Zionism? It's really getting to be a problem, this tyranny of the left. They're adamant about the truth of their narrative and have the right to shut down other narratives. That's the way it is in all totalitarian cultures, like the old Soviet Union and Arab countries to this day, to Iran, where no newspaper can deviate from the government line and survive. 2 weeks ago, in a classroom at the infamous UC Irvine campus, 12 pro-Israel students had gathered to watch an Israeli film about the IDF, a feature beneath the helmet, I think, when a mob of some 50 anti-Israelites showed up, chanted, cursed, tried to break in, wouldn't let the screening continue, and the campus police had to escort the beleaguered Jews to safety. The chancellor of UC Irvine, Howard Gilman, said this crossed the line of civility. And the Orange County Register newspaper reported that the administration is, quote, investigating whether disciplinary or legal actions are appropriate. Please. My commentary to this is, you got to be kidding, Howard. Henceforth, he should announce that every Jewish activity on campus will be surveilled by hidden security cameras and patrolled by plainclothes policemen who will photograph and arrest any disruptor, will then be immediately expelled from UC Irvine. That's the only way to deal with this. Howard Gilman should demand from Governor Jerry Brown deploying National Guardsmen, if necessary, to protect Jewish students in these situations, like President Eisenhower ordered troops to escort and protect Negroes entering Little Rock, Arkansas High School when segregation was outlawed. In 1968, the Columbia University campus exploded with student rebellion that captured the attention of the media for weeks. The police, New York City cops, were called in to clear the buildings. Heads were cracked. It was a police riot. But in the end, some students were expelled. Yours truly was in the middle of this circus. The following year, I became a graduate student at the University of Chicago. And what do you know? The radicals there tried to imitate what had happened at Columbia the previous spring. Only the administration, after clearing out the administration building that had been occupied by rebel students, expelled like 80 of them, which shocked those spoiled intellectuals, but did put a stop to this phenomenon. If American Jewry were not so bloodless, think of all the Jews in California that they would take up arms against this growing poisonous anti-Jew atmosphere on college campuses. But I doubt they will, precisely because they are so empty of any knowledge of Jewishness and commitment to it. All they can do is pretend it's not happening.
המבדיל בין קודש לחול. חטותינו עם חול, זרענו וחספנו יער בכחול וככוכבים בלילה. המבדיל בין קודש לחול, חטותינו עם חול, זרענו וחספנו יער בכחול וככוכבים בלילה. יום פנה כצל תומר, אקרא לכם עליי גומר, אמר שומר אתה בוקר וגם לילה. המבדיל בין קודש לחול, חטותינו זרענו וחספנו יער וכחול וככוכבים בלילה. המבדיל בין קודש לחול, חטותינו עם חול, זרענו וחספנו יער וכחול וככוכבים בלילה. צדקתך כהר תבוא על חטאי,
Last item, a soldier was walking innocently in Tel Aviv, a height of Western civilization in Israel, and he was attacked from behind with a screwdriver, I think, stabbed several times by a 17-year-old, according to Ynet News, Palestinian from the West Bank. It will be a better Israel when Israeli news sources write he is a 17-year-old Ishmaelite from Samaria. Okay, that's it for this Tuesday night of this week, and I'll be back, God willing, on Thursday night. Until then, Lana Tov, Meretz Yisrael.